Thank you, Mary. This is Natalie. The call recordings have been started. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome all to the GNSA Working Group Newcomer Open House session on the 12th of March 2015. On the call today, we have Katie McKnight on the audio bridge, Heather Forrest, Carlos Powell, Klaus, Roger Carney, Sarah Bocchi, and Tracy Hines. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Glenn Saint-Géry, Julie Charvolin, Lars Hofstad, and myself, Natalie Peregrine. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for purposes of the transcription. Thank you ever so much, and over to you, Mary.
Thank you, Natalie, and on behalf of the rest of the GNSO policy support team, several of whom, as Natalie has said, are on the call today, I want to welcome you all, and I would like to thank our speaker for today, Heather Forrest, who is a GNSO council member, who will be taking us through the various steps of getting involved in the GNSO. So my role here is really just to introduce Heather and the topic, but before I do that, we thought that it would be helpful to show you who's who on the GNSO policy support team. Some of you may have already met or heard from or been in communication with David Olive, our vice president, who's located in Istanbul, one of the three hub offices of ICANN, the other two being in Los Angeles and Singapore. I'm a senior policy director, as is Marika Konings, who is also the team leader of our little team. She's in Brussels. And we have Glenn, who's with us today. And Glenn is indispensable. If you have not already found that, you will. And she basically is the person to go to about everything secretariat and non-secretariat related. That's me, and there's also Julie and Lars. And Lars, I think you're on the call today as well, and you see that we are located in different parts of the world as well. I will say that Julie and myself are not attached to an ICANN office. We work remotely. And so we do have a fairly diverse team across different offices, including some home offices. Steve is in Los Angeles. Barry is in Arizona, and Natalie, who you just heard from a few minutes ago, is in France, and she will be running these webinars. And so to the extent that you get involved with our working groups and our various efforts, you will be interacting with Natalie and quite a few of us very, very often. So we had asked quite a number of people, including folks who are new to ICANN, what were the sorts of topics that they were most interested in terms of how it would make it easier for you to get involved in our working groups, the policy development process, and the many initiatives that the GNSO is working on. And for those of you in the Adobe Connect, these are the topics that came up, and Heather will take us through each of them, as well as Natalie. But before I hand over to Heather, Natalie, I was wondering, for those folks who are new and who may not be as familiar with using the Adobe Connect virtual meeting room, would you mind spending a couple of minutes taking us through how that works?
Thank you very much, Mary. This is Natalie from staff. So most of you have made it to the Adobe Connect room. Congratulations, that's a good first step achieved. For those of you on the audio bridge, if you would like to refer back to the email invitation you received with the connection details, you'll find an Adobe Connect URL there. If you click on that, you'll be led to a login page. So please, when you get to the login page, don't be confused by the host and the guest login options. Host logins are only for staff. So all you need to do is to log in as a guest using your first and your last name. This is very important. It's important for attendance purposes and also for the Adobe Connect room mechanics once you're in the call. So once you've done that, you get into an Adobe Connect room. Most of the working group Adobe Connect rooms are set up in exactly the same way as this one, so they'll be fairly easy to identify. What you have in the center is what you call the share pod. That's where you'll have presentations and also working documents. As participants, you cannot modify the document at all, so you don't need to worry about your mouse hovering over this pod. Where you can participate, however, is in the Adobe Connect Room chat pod, which is at the bottom, where you see some participants have started a dialogue. What you might not know is that the content of Adobe Connect chat pods during working group calls are kept. They are archived as part of the transparency procedure. The content of this pod will then be sent after the call to working group members. So if you do have anything that you want to talk about, for instance, technical issues on the call or maybe requiring a dial-out, and you'd rather your personal phone number not appear in this chat, it's a good idea to use the private chat. This is not archived in any way. To do this, you hover your mouse over the name of the person you want to talk to, so let's say a member of staff, for instance, and you have a little drop-down menu that allows you to start a private chat. There, you can correspond, like in any other private chat, and state your worries or your technical issues, or ask for dial-out if needed. So it's quite a good tip. Another feature that you might not be aware of is, as well as being able to dial into a conference call via the telephone, you can also use voice over IP. And if you look at the list of participants, you have microphone icons, some of which are muted. The ones which are muted, this means that these participants have activated their Adobe Connector microphone. So to do this, if you would rather participate via your laptop rather than your phone, you go to the telephone icon at the top of the Adobe Connect Room toolbar and follow the instructions there to connect via your computer. Now, you'll notice activation has been successful when the telephone icon becomes a microphone icon. However, exactly in the same way as with the telephone, you must keep your microphone muted at all times. So to do this, you would click on the white arrow to the right of your microphone icon, and there you have the option to mute and unmute. Once your microphone is muted, as you can see again on the participant list, you'll have a red line come through it. To unmute, you would go to exactly the same spot. So it's quite important to do so. One of the traditions in working groups is the hands raised. In a working group, given often the high number of participants, you cannot just speak into the call. There's what we call a question queue. So to do this, you raise your hand by going to the raise hand icon. So that's a little man with his hand raised at the top of the Adobe Connect toolbar, and you click on that to raise your hand, much as Mary has done. If you look in the attendees list, Mary as host has got a little icon with her hand raised. Hand raised does not give you automatic permission to speak into the call. This merely puts you into a question queue. And going back to the importance of logging in with your first and last name, it's important you do so. If you do want to ask a question or comment, the chair can therefore call you out by your first and last name, so you're immediately recognizable, and tell you when it's your turn to comment. Another important feature here is to remember to lower your hand. I think about once every working group call, someone will forget to lower their hand. This therefore tells the chair that they've still got a comment or another question to ask. I think you'll hear quite frequently the participants apologizing for this and saying that it's an old hand. This means nothing more than the fact that they've forgotten to lower their hand. Another icon you can see in the drop-down menu, and if you all click on the little right-hand arrow on the raise hand icon, is the green tick agree and the red cross disagree. These are quite convenient, for example, as a simplified polling system. If the chair, for instance, wants to ask the members on the call if they think there's a need for an extra call the following week, rather than have people writing their agreement or disagreement in the chat, which will take too long to read, he'll ask them to agree or disagree with this green tick and red cross. And that means that in a simple view of the attendance list, he gets a good idea of what the room is feeling. So just to make sure that you have been following, it's just the beginning of the webinar after all, I'd like to ask you all to please raise your hands, go into the raise hand option on the top of the SEU toolbar. Perfect. Thank you ever so much. Another thing, if you look at the attendance list now, the attendance list is normally in alphabetical, or by raising your hand, this pushes your name to the top of the list. So it also gives you a good idea of what position you're holding in the question queue. Okay, excellent. Can you please all lower your hands? And by a show of green tick or red cross, let me know how you think this explanation has been going up to now. The enthusiasm is overwhelming. Thank you ever so much, everyone. Please don't hesitate. If you have further questions about the AC room, there are no silly questions with these type of interfaces. So please don't hesitate to, well, clearly write them in the chat, private message me in the chat, or else you can send a quick email to the GNSO Secretariat. I'll put the email in the chat pod now. And you can ask any conference call or the other connect room questions. With that, thank you ever so much, and I'll hand it back to Heather.
Thank you very much, Natalie and Mary. I think that was particularly useful so that folks can participate in today's call. And as I've put down there in the chat just before we commence, please do, by all means, if you have questions as we go, raise your hand on the spot, and I will be very happy to have you raise your question at the moment that it arises, as opposed to holding on to it and perhaps leaving your train of thought. Likewise, if there's something that you're not sure about, if there's something that you have a question about that's been said, please, you know, raise that, however you feel most comfortable in doing so. What we'll talk about today, as was indicated on the previous slide, we'll go through a number of fairly dense conceptual topics relating to GNSO policy development. We'll talk about the PDP process. We'll talk about the scope of that PDP process, what can be a subject of a PDP and what comes out of a PDP. And we'll talk about working groups and how working groups work and the mechanics of how they're formed and how you go about participating. And as I understand it, in being asked to chair this session, this is one of the key bits of information, really, that you folks are interested in, which is how to better and more effectively get engaged in the GNSO process. And really the easiest and quickest and most direct way to do that is through participating in a working group. So we'll spend some time there. We need to first begin by conceptualizing why we have working groups and what it is that working groups contribute to. And to understand that, we need to understand the PDP process. So if we can look at the next slide and specifically what we tend to call the snake. When we look at this thing, what you're looking at here is a diagram of what we refer to under the ICANN bylaws as the PDP process. The reason why we repeat the word process in there, PDP stands for policy development process. We say PDP process because a P, capital P, capital D, capital P, the acronym there, is really the term used by the ICANN bylaws. So this isn't just any policy development process. It's a process that is specifically outlined in ICANN's corporate bylaws. And managing the policy development process is a task specifically given to the council by the ICANN bylaws. We'll talk more about what is within the scope of Council's policy development when we get to the notion of consensus policy and picket fence a bit later in the session. But to start things off, let's say I'm a lawyer and I like to know what the actual language is rather than hear someone's interpretation or summarization of it. So for any of you who feel the same way, what the bylaws specifically say is this: there shall be a policy development body known as the Generic Name Supporting Organization, or GNSO, which shall be responsible for developing and recommending to the ICANN board substantive policies relating to generic top-level domains. We'll see that specific language has an impact, a significant impact, on what it is that the GNSO is able to do under the bylaws. Now, if we look at this, the Z or the snake here, the diagrammatic representation of the policy development process, you see that this commences with a request for an issue report. Now, this is something that the GNSO Council is entitled under the bylaws to vote on. And in fact, requesting an issue report requires an affirmative vote of more than one-fourth of each house or a majority of one house of the GNSO. Now, we'll say more about the actual structure of the GNSO closer to the end of today's discussion. But for now, let's just say there are two houses. One of them is called the Contractual Parties House. That's comprised of our contractual parties, the registries and registrars. And the other one is the Non-Contracted Parties House, which, simply put, is everyone else enrolled in the GNSO. So again, to request an issue report, the council will vote, and it requires an affirmative vote of more than a quarter of each house or a majority of one house. Now, staff does the heavy lifting here in terms of the issue report. They identify the relevant data, put this together in a comprehensive document for review and discussion, not just by council or the GNSO, but published for the entire community. Another thing to remember here is that the GNSO Council is not the only part of the ICANN structure that can request an issue report. The board can do this, and another advisory committee can do this as well. Within 45 calendar days after a motion from council, or if the issue report has been requested from another AC within ICANN, or there's an instruction from the board, staff will develop and publish what's called the preliminary issue report. And that process involves seeking input from the community through public comments and reply posts. So staff puts together this initial report. That report then goes out to the community. Comment on this, provide input on this, and essentially give us an idea of your sense of where we are now. Staff review the public comments, and this is an absolutely imperative part of the process. Revisions are made to the preliminary issue report based on the public comments received. And it's not until that process has taken place that a final issue report is published for consideration and review by the GNSO Council. Now, it falls on council to make a determination on the matters, the recommendations, the outcomes of the issue report, of the issue report, yeah? And in particular, what council needs to do here is determine whether or not to initiate the policy development process. Now, initiating a policy development process, the voting thresholds, how many members of council need to vote for, depends, it actually changes on whether or not something is within the scope of what the GNSO is required to do under the ICANN bylaws. As you might imagine, the voting threshold is higher to the extent that what the issue report is proposing and the PDP relates to something that is not directly within scope of the GNSO. So, to the extent that council votes affirmatively and says that we adopt the issue report and wish to commence a PDP, a working group is formed. And this really is the heart of our discussion today, is working groups, what they do, and how they contribute to this PDP process. Essentially, the working group is the substantive work team that takes up the platform of the data and the information provided by staff as developed through the public comments process and the reply process. And the working group develops a program, a plan for addressing the issues that are identified, for solving any problems that have been identified, for rectifying any gaps that have been identified in the policy process. A formal call goes out to the various stakeholder groups, constituencies within the GNSO, and then other SOs and ACs within the ICANN environment for input into the working group. And indeed for participants into the working group. Increasingly, cross-community working groups are being formed, and these are constituted not just of liaisons from other SOs and ACs, but members of other SOs and ACs. And what we need to do, I suppose, at this stage is to differentiate cross-community working groups from GNSO working groups. And the way to distinguish these things is based on their charter and essentially based on who charters the working group. If the GNSO charters a working group, then it is a GNSO working group, and GNSO guidelines apply, and the outcome of the process pumps into a PDP. If we're dealing with a cross-constituency working group, then we're dealing with a working group that is formed or chartered by more than one organization within ICANN, whether it's the GNSO, the CCNSO, ALAC. We're dealing with other groups being involved and formally commencing the process. So that differentiates the two. For today's purposes, this is a GNSO-coordinated call, and in fact, the procedures around how a cross-community working group are slightly different. So I'll leave them to one side. I encourage you, if you do have questions around those, to hang on to them and put them into the chat, and staff can make note of them, and we can perhaps deal with them in another call or another environment. I know that is, given that we have an increasing number of cross-community working groups, that's an area where we as a community probably need to be better in informing ourselves on how those work. But for now, we'll progress with the GNSO working group structure and how it operates and how it fits into the PDP process. So if we go back and we're looking at the snake, at the Z here, and we're at the stage of the working group, and the working group must determine itself how it wants to go about doing its work, if you like, the methodology of what it does. And most working groups establish within the GNSO will meet. I suppose there is a trend that we meet every 2 weeks. Some groups will meet every week by teleconference. I'm happy to see that I've got several colleagues from council on the call. And by all means, if anything that I say, and I've said this to staff as well, if your experience differs in any respect, please speak up either in the chat or raise your hand. But in my experience, most of the groups that I'm involved in, we meet fortnightly, some of them weekly, by teleconference, and we use the Adobe Connect just as Natalie described in the beginning, and Natalie will come back at the end of the call and offer some more tips around the mechanics of how to effectively participate in working group meetings. One thing to bear in mind, and I offer this from a personal perspective, is that other entities within ICANN, other supporting organizations, the CCNSO, the GAC and the ALAC, they may have different working methods and timelines than the GNSO. I've discovered in a cross-community working group environment that the CCNSO general methodology and meeting timeline tends to be monthly rather than the GNSO's fortnightly or weekly. And it means that things progress more slowly in that space. On the other hand, folks from the CCNSO and ALAC, when they join GNSO-led working groups, may find the pace uncomfortably fast or a bit overwhelming, too much work. So it's something to bear in mind when working with other members of the community. In addition to the mechanics of how the working group operates, the working group will also develop a plan as to how it approaches the substance of the issues that gave rise to it, if you like, a sort of work plan. This ordinarily often also sets a timeline and identifies deliverables. This is not to say that this is something that's fixed in stone. It's often something that a working group comes back to, provided it stays within the parameters of its original charter, to determine how it is that it needs to go about delivering on that charter. Now, the basic operational framework of how working groups work is set out in the GNSO working group guidelines, which we'll discuss shortly. And suffice to say at this point that the aim of those guidelines is really to try and achieve productivity and effectiveness. And that's increasingly important as the workload of the GNSO and the community more generally increases. And I suppose it's a good opportunity for me to take a pause. And if anyone has any concerns or questions, I've seen some good comments in the good questions in the chat from Amr and others. And thank you, Mary, for fielding them. That's super helpful. Mary makes an excellent point that the working groups work plan and charter are published and publicly available. They're all on the GNSO website, and meetings and calls are recorded. And let's talk about that, how meetings and calls are actually conducted. The working group on progressing in its substantive work, what it will do in the course of its meetings and as it develops and it comes to deliver on the charter, will publish an initial report. And that provides the community with an opportunity to become fully informed of the WG's progress, the working group's progress to that stage, and comment upon its preliminary findings and conclusions. The public comments period and subsequent reply period are the formal means for this input to be received, but informally, community members can communicate their views to working group members. There's almost always a list that's used, an email list that's used for the everyday working dialogue of a working group, and comments can be raised there. They can be raised in meetings, and to the extent that you wish to make your views known to a working group at a time period when the comment period is not open, then these channels are available to you. It's increasingly the case as well that in addition to members, and very many working groups are open to anyone who wants to join. I guess some folks tend to be a bit reluctant to join a working group that's already been formed. Increasingly, working groups have observers. That tends to happen where the number of participants is limited, and that tends to be cross-community working group environments. My advice to you in this is, to the extent that a working group has already formed and you didn't know about it at the time and you wish to join an existing group, one that's already started in its work, the best thing that you can do is ask. Simply ask, is it too late to join? Is it too late to participate? And you may be very pleasantly surprised by the answer. Carlos in the comment notes that it's a good time to mention that some reports are open for comment. Indeed, the initial report of a working group is always open for public comment in the public comment period. And that's, in fact, a critical process, a sub-process within the PDP, is this notion of continuous feedback from the community. After reviewing the public comments and revising the initial report to the extent that this is called for by what's been received in the comments period and reply period, the working group produces a final report for review by the GNSO Council. Bear in mind that the outcome of this process is what we call consensus policy, and consensus, true meaning of the word. So public comments must be incorporated if the final report is to reflect true consensus. Now, that's often challenging, right, because it's often the case that that public comments are received that may conflict with other comments that have been received. So this is an interesting process. It's also interesting to note that once a PDP has been initiated, and prior to the publication of a final report, the GNSO Council can, under the bylaws, terminate a PDP. They can only do that for a significant cause, and it has to pass Council with a supermajority vote in favor of termination. I had a quick round-the-houses chat with staff to see if we could think of any instances and when this was done. We know that termination has happened. Whether it happened under this particular clause, we're not sure. In any event, it's good to know that that is possible, that the commencement of a PDP doesn't inevitably lead to the conclusion of a PDP. So here we are now. We have an initial report that has turned into a final report from a working group, and it will set out various recommendations. If the recommendations pass the voting requirements of the GNSO Council, the GNSO Council then communicates those recommendations to the ICANN board. And Tracy, I see your fantastic comment about House, question about House. We'll talk about what the various houses of the GNSO are a little bit later on, but for now, let's say this, that there are two houses within the GNSO, the contracted party house and the non-contracted party house. Contracted parties being registries and registrars, and non-contracted being other members of the GNSO. And we have a question: what criteria will be used to determine when an action should be addressed by a policy process and when it should be considered for implementation? That's a brilliant question, and I'll talk a bit about policy versus implementation when we get to the end of this this PDP process explanation. So if the recommendations pass council then makes them to the ICANN board. This kicks off another community consultation process, which runs its course before the board will put the matter to a vote. Under the bylaws, if PDP recommendations are approved by a supermajority of the GNSO, then it's required that they are adopted by the board, except in a very limited circumstance. So it has to be more than two-thirds of the members of the board vote to say that the policy is not in the best interest of the ICANN community or ICANN. It's an interesting point, let's say. We often refer the community to the strength and if you like, effect of GAC advice. And we don't often point this out, that the bylaws do specifically say that to the extent that PDP recommendations are approved by the GNSO by a supermajority, then it's required that they're adopted by the board unless more than two-thirds of the members vote against. If the GNSO council recommendation was approved by less than a supermajority, then a majority vote of the board is sufficient to determine or to reject the recommendations, if you like. Once recommendations have been accepted by the board, they then progress to the implementation phase, and this is the phase driven by ICANN staff. The new GTLD program provided some very interesting touch points, for example, around RPM requirements, at which the community had to come to grips with this notion of what was policy and what was implementation. I would say, from my perspective as a community member, I don't think that the answers to these questions are still entirely clear. I think this is something that we have more to do as a community to get a better understanding of what is policy versus what is implementation. It's hard to talk about this in a vacuum. You really do need a specific example to frame it with. And unfortunately, the new GTLD program brought up a number of them, and I'm fairly confident that a few more will come up along the way. So when these do arise and you hear this discussion around is this policy or is this implementation, what you need to do is understand that the relevance of that discussion or why we ask that discussion is it's really one of responsibility. Policy, remember, is the role of the GNSO, policy development, and implementation is not the role of the GNSO, it's the role of staff. So that, hence the importance of that discussion. I can't say we know which one is which, but at least we know who does what.
Heather, this is Mary. I think
yes.
That one of our participants, Katie McKnight, had her hand raised. I don't know, Katie, if you had a question that you can type in the chat. I don't know if your audio is enabled so that you can ask the question.
Forgive me for not seeing that. And Amber is typing as well, so perhaps we will take a breath and we'll see where we are. Ah, good, and Katie's typing too.
Oh, okay. Katie, you were unmuted anyway, but thanks for letting us know that Heather's answered your question. And Heather, as I hand it back to you, this is great. I think it's a lot of great information. And so for everyone else on the call, if you do have a question, feel free to type it in the chat or raise your hand, whichever works best for you, and we will monitor who's got a question. Thank you. Heather, back to you.
Great. Thanks very much, Mary, and for keeping me on track, too. No. A final point, and again, not one that comes up terribly frequently, but it's good to know, is that before a PDP recommendation goes to final approval by the ICANN board, it can actually be modified and amended by council. So again, there are a number of checks and balances within the system that ensure, again, with the view that what we're trying to achieve is consensus policy, that we get the wording exactly right. Now, with that in mind, let's have a look at the next slide, and we'll see what else we need to say about policy development process working groups. What I would like to emphasize here, I mean, you'll see the requirements of how a working group operates, and the key point to take from this is that the policy development process isn't just something that's developed over time. It's not just some sort of organic thing. It is itself prescribed by the bylaws. In developing the initial report and developing the final report, there are formal opportunities for members outside of the working group to provide input, and that's an important thing to bear in mind, that this is really a community-driven process. Right, so let's have a bit of a discussion then around, good, we've got some links to further reading, and everything that I've spoken about today can be found in one of these three documents. The bylaws, particularly helpful. Again, I'm a lawyer and I like to go directly to the source, and I found in preparing for today's session it quite useful to go back and look at the specific language of the bylaws. And what it sets out that the GNSO can and cannot do. The PDP manual and the PDP overview are likewise very helpful, and you'll see graphics like the snake and other things there. So if we turn now to the consensus policy and the picket fence, let's start with consensus policy. Consensus policy is policy that's developed through the multi-stakeholder model, through this this sometimes chunky process that we have, and it's applicable to all contracted parties. Thus, consensus policy has its origins in the contractual relationships between ICANN and registries and registrars. To identify subjects that can be the basis of consensus policy, we really just need to ask a few questions. First of all, is it identified as a subject of consensus policy in the registry agreement between ICANN and registries, or in the registrar agreement between ICANN and registrars? And if it is identified in one of those agreements as the subject of consensus policy, then it's consensus policy. Another question to ask is it enforceable by ICANN against registries and registrars through some other contractual requirement? More likely, it's something that arises under the registry agreement or the RAA. For example, and just to give a good example of this so that you can identify a bit more clearly, the registry or registrar accreditation agreement, or RAA, identifies the resolution of disputes in relation to the registration of domain names as a topic of consensus policy. It's clear from that then, an easily identifiable example of consensus policy is the UDRP, which is the administrative procedure that underpins our dispute resolution process in relation to domain name allocation. Now, consensus policy is limited by the constraints that you see here on the slide, right? And in fact, let's see, it's the next slide. So consensus policy limited by these things, that the policy does not unreasonably restrain competition. It ensures interoperability, reliability, and stability of the Internet. So these things come primarily out of the agreement between ICANN, registries, and registrars. Now, when we refer to the picket fence, and I'm going to try to, Amar, in wrapping up, it may be helpful to list the different points along the PDP where public comments are solicited. I think that's a very helpful idea. Thank you very much, Amar. I'm going to try to tackle this picket fence thing, and I'm going to start by saying this. Picket fence refers to all of the matters that fall into this definition of consensus policy. In other words, picket fence is a way of describing matters within the scope of GNSO policy development. I want to tackle this business of why we use the phrase picket fence, because I think the phrase picket fence is difficult if you're not an American. Picket fence is an American metaphor, and it refers to the fence around a homeowner's yard. Everything inside the fence is the homeowner's domain, right? It's within the homeowner's control. We have this stereotypical image of a two-bedroom house that has this little white fence around it and a lovely green yard. Everything inside the fence belongs to the home. Everything outside the fence, not part of the home. Likewise with the GNSO. Everything inside the picket fence is inside of the GNSO's authority under the bylaws and its agreements with contracted parties, and it's relevant to carrying out the obligations that ICANN has under those agreements with contracted parties. Things outside the fence are outside of that scope of authority. This doesn't mean that the GNSO can't develop policy on these topics or talk about policy on these topics that are outside the fence, merely that any outcomes of that process are not automatically binding on contracted parties as consensus policy. I'll stop, I'll take a breath, only because those two very difficult concepts, we toss around these phrases all the time, consensus policy and picket fence. And if anyone has any concerns or questions, then I'll be very happy to answer those. And Tom, I see your question, how much time might a working group member expect to participate in a typical PDP? We've only just had this discussion in the context of the non-contracted parties intersessional, and we said roughly a PDP. Mary, I'm going to ask you to jump in. What was the number we actually came to that we said? How many months was a typical PDP?
Well, Heather, you know, there's really two parts to this, right? There's the duration of the PDP, and the answer to that depends on how you measure it. If you go back to the snake diagram, for example, you know, the technical answer is you really start from the time the issue report is requested. But in terms of participant time spent, that probably starts assuming that, you know, you may or may not have participated in the public comment to the issue report and so forth, but you join the working group, your timing really starts from when the working group is formed and chartered. So in terms of sort of looking ahead, if you go from the start of the working group to the submission of your report to the GNSO Council, and as Heather noted with the snake diagram, there are steps to be taken by the council and staff and the board after that. But if you just look at the strict working group timeline, that could be something like a year or more, or less, depending on whether it's an expedited PDP or not. But within that time frame, it's up to each working group to determine its milestones. And part of that includes determining how often and how frequently it wants to meet. Typically, most working groups will do a call that lasts maybe an hour or 90 minutes for every week. It's much more common to have weekly rather than meetings that go every 2 weeks, simply just to maintain the momentum. So you're really looking at a minimum of a couple of hours a week, and I say a minimum because on top of the call, there are obviously email discussions that go on between the calls. There may be documents and drafts for you to look at. But one of the things that we are not able to highlight today is that for folks who are time-pressed but are interested in an issue, or for folks who, for various reasons, can't, you know, participate fully, there is an observer status to a working group where you can still track the discussions, but you're not obligated to participate in the calls. So that's a rough minimum, I would say. And, of course, some people do more. And there are also times when some people in the course of the year or year and a half, as Amherst pointed out in the chat, might have to step back because of work or personal commitments. And most groups and the working group chairs are, I want to say, really good about accommodating people's demands and schedules, because we all understand that this is all volunteer work. So, Heather, Tom, I hope that's helpful.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Mary. I appreciate your input there. I'm mindful of time, and I want to say a bit about the GNSO working group guidelines, because, again, this goes to some of the questions that we're asking here. And I also want to leave some time for Natalie to describe the mechanics, the hints and tips about how to effectively participate. So I'll push forward, bearing in mind that if you do have questions, Mary, I appreciate you poking me too. If the question is one that you think we ought to address in the call, working group guidelines. These put more specifics into the process of forming and operating a working group. And they're best practice guidelines that are geared towards really to optimizing transparency, efficiency, productivity, all things geared towards that aim, let's say. And they're important things given the overload of activity we're experiencing in the ICANN ecosystem. For example, working group guidelines, they outline the process by which volunteers are called for when a working group is created. So this might be something that you are wondering about. And specifically, when a working group is created by the GNSO secretariat identifies, or, you know, there's a call for volunteers. Volunteers will then respond to whoever made that call. The call goes out as widely as possible, again, bearing in mind that what we're trying to create here is consensus policy. So we seek input from all members of the community that are willing. And the secretariat will, first of all, identify that the volunteer is a real person, and secondly, request that that person complete a statement of interest, what you'll see abbreviated as SOI. Statements of interest are a cornerstone of the bottom-up multi-stakeholder model, and it's clear that few, if any, of us participate in ICANN just for fun, just because we have nothing better to do. Many participants represent commercial entities or particular interests, and so the SOI is an opportunity to disclose those interests and affiliations, and it's a living document. It's able to be consulted by the community at any time, and it should be kept up to date by each individual that participates in the environment. The working group guidelines, they also address basics like the election of a chair or co-chairs of the working group, essentially saying it's up to the working group to determine how many of these are, or whether co-chairs or sub-chairs are needed. If the GNSO didn't already identify a particular individual to fill these roles, then one of the first tasks of the working group is to elect these people, and the guidelines provide some structure around how those elections can take place. There's often a call for volunteers for chairing, and I would say this, don't be afraid to volunteer for these roles, these leadership roles. You're extremely well supported by staff. I currently co-chair a cross-constituency working group and have a number of GNSO policy staff in support, and I found the process of chairing far more rewarding than simply being a part of the working group, simply because of the relationship that I've developed with staff and the knowledge I've gained from them, from their experience and their guidance. The GNSO is extraordinarily well-resourced with really lovely people who are extraordinarily good at what they do, and more importantly, they're extremely patient and willing to teach the community, and I think that alone is an excellent reason to get involved in a working group, to get to further your own knowledge, learning by others who do this day in, day out. One important thing to say about joining a working group is that you need to be willing to participate. In your first working group experience, you might find that it takes some time to find your feet, to understand particular acronyms that are relevant to the working group's work, to get to know the personalities of others in the working group. By all means, take some time to observe, but when you feel you're able to do so, contribute. Don't be afraid to take on drafting tasks or data gathering tasks. Don't be frightened by the experience levels, whether high or low, of others. It's amazing what a motivated person can contribute, and often a newcomer's perspective is just what a group needs to break out of a well-established thinking rut. Another important point to say about working groups and how they operate is that minority views can be captured in a working group report. So don't feel from the outset that the outcomes demand unanimity, and don't let that hamper your participation and hamper your unbiased and genuine input. The GNSO brings together a great diversity of interests and perspectives. It's often complained that we take forever to do things in the PDP process, and what amazes me is that we can actually achieve anything at all given the great diversity of views that we bring together in the GNSO. It's a real testament to the robustness of the PDP process. I think on the we often hear the complaints and the PDP process is broken, and on the contrary, I think to the extent that we achieve outcomes, it's clearly not broken at all. Bottom line, don't be afraid to participate. My recommendation to you is read through the working group guidelines. Just familiarize yourself with how it's supposed to work, and do so knowing that many of the old-timers don't actually know how it's supposed to work. They think they do. They may look like they do, but it's often not the case. So go in knowing the process, and then do whatever it is that you do best, and participate in that way. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Natalie.
Thank you ever so much, Heather. And yes, this is Natalie from staff. So Heather's entirely right with what she says regarding the working group. The best thing is to read up a little bit beforehand to make sure it doesn't seem as daunting. So as she says, you have the working group guidelines. Equally, what you have is the GNSO website. So, I mean, rather than show you slides with many screenshots of different areas of the website, I've put in the URLs in the web link pod you have under the attendance pod. So feel free to keep those. And in any case, they're also on the slides at the end, so you'll have them when the slides are circulated. So the main area to find information and between flying from one website to another, from wiki pages, and we finally managed to have most of the information centralized, and that's on the GNSO website. So on the GNSO website homepage, you have a box on the left-hand side. It's called a quick info box. And from there, you can basically navigate to everything you need, whether it's simple curiosity as to what a GNSO working group is about, or whether you're interested in one issue in particular, or if you're already a member of a working group and need to check up on the reference documents. So from that link, what you'll get to is your immediate working group website page on the GNSO website. So the GNSO website basically deals with the finalized documents, the finalized works of a working group. If you want to go to a place which is more of a workspace, so where you have the ongoing work, you're better to go to the ICANN wiki. Now, the ICANN wiki used to be a jungle of information. It's actually now quite pleasingly structured. So what you'll do by navigating from the GNSO website to your working group webpage and then on to their respective wiki spaces is you head towards what's called the dashboard. So the dashboard is simply clicking on a main GNSO tab at the top of the wiki space. And from there, you have access to everything you need regarding ongoing activity, be it council activity and working group and joint working group activities. For ease of navigation, they're all structured in exactly the same place. Exactly the same way. You'll have the reference documents. You'll have a list of the members, of the chairs, of the observers. You'll have also the attendance sheets there. So that's crucial, and it's become fairly easy to look around. Equally, it's open to everyone. There's no need for login. So that's one obstacle removed. If ever you've missed a meeting or you're interested in a working group and you'd like to find on really what goes on during that working group call, during that hour of activity, the space for that is a GNSO master calendar. So in the same way as today's MP3 recording, the transcript, and the slide deck, all these will be posted on the GNSO master calendar. You'll also have the link in the URL box in the AC room. You have also the time and date of the working group calls and of the webinars. It's incredibly important to refer to that calendar at all times, because you will have different time changes, cancellations, etc. So it's very important to have that as a quick link. So that's basically where you find all the main information. I wouldn't bother spreading myself out a lot more if I'm just interested in finding out what GNSO working groups are about. If you do need to push further, however, you have these reference documents here. This is fairly heavy reading. However, it is ideal as a backdrop to any working group activity. Other than flying around the website and the wiki looking for information, one of the main places to go for me would be, if you're already on a working group, would be the working group mailing list. We often see on mailing lists how one member will ask what they seem to think is a very silly question or with a very obvious answer, and will in fact spark a debate on the mailing list. So as Heather was saying, you must not be put off by the perceived experience of some members. Any input is helpful. Equally, if you're not yet part of a Janus or working group and are intrigued or curious, motivated, you must please not hesitate to contact any member of staff. If you're not sure how to contact us, our email addresses are always built in the same way. It's our first name dot our last name at icann.org. So that might make it a little easier. And please don't hesitate to contact us. So once you have become part of a working group, you've filled in your statement of interest, as Heather was saying earlier, you will be asked what mailing list status you would like. Now, this is a bit confusing, especially because it's fairly recent. But it was done for two reasons. One reason was to alleviate the inbox load for certain members, but more importantly, to provide accurate reflection of members' activity in a working group. So by this means, if you are simply curious about working group activity, it would make sense for you to ask to be an observer. This means that you have access to the contents of the public mailing list of the working group, but are not subscribed to the closed mailing list of the working group on which conference call details are circulated. If you are ready and you have the time and the motivation to be fully involved in a working group, then you would ask to be a member. This means that you are able to post on both the public and the closed mailing list and therefore have access to the conference call. It's important to note, however, that as an observer, you still have access to the same information because you still have access to the GNSO Master Calendar where all the recordings of these conference calls are posted. So again, in the interest of transparency, as an observer, you still have all the information available to provide input. If you are subscribed as an observer and you see the working group taking an angle that interests you, that you would like to be more active in, a simple email, as it's on the slide, a simple email to the GNSO Secretariat, providing no justification whatsoever, just a simple request saying that you would like to become a member, and we will change your subscription on the mailing list immediately. This can be done, of course, several times during your participation in a working group. Once you are a member of a working group, and we covered a few of these steps with the Adobe Connect room earlier, it is always the same procedure to take part in working group conference calls. As a member, so subscribed to the closed and public mailing list, you will, a week before the working group meeting is scheduled, receive an email invitation, pretty much the same content as the one you had today for this session. Therefore, with the Adobe Connect Room URL and the dial-in numbers. If for some reason you cannot make the conference call, it's very important to reply to this email invitation, just saying that you will be unable to make it. We do not need to have a reason. You are under no obligation to provide justification. Simply, this counts as an apology. The reason why this is important is because, as we said earlier, attendance is taken for these working group calls. And in the attendance, apologies are taken into account. So you have those present, those who have sent an apology, and those who are absent. And the apologies are also part of the official roll call beginning the working group meeting. So it's quite important. Equally, if for some reason you're traveling, you don't have the bandwidth to connect your Adobe Connect Room audio via voice over IP, you do not want to incur international telephone charges, you're very welcome to require a dial-out. Dial-out means that a few minutes, generally 5 or 6 minutes, before the scheduled start time of a call, the operator of our telecom provider will dial out to you. For this, it's a great idea if you could provide not one, but two contact phone numbers, just in case for network reasons we can't get through to you. And this also means that if you are dialed out by the operator, should your call drop to join the call, there's no need to panic, the operator will dial back out to you for the remaining of the call. So you have that guaranteed too. Once it's time to join the conference call, And it's always good to dial in a few minutes early if you are using the phone bridge. This is because providers experience a lot of heavy traffic, participation traffic at the top of the hour. So it's good to join in 2 or 3 minutes prior to the scheduled start time. The operator will ask you to provide your first and last name. This is not intrusive in any way. It's only for, again, attendance reasons. And if you can only join the audio bridge, so the phone bridge, rather than the Adobe Connect room, clearly you will not be able to, as we mentioned at the beginning of the call, raise your hand or express agreement or disagreement because you won't be in the Adobe Connect room. In that case, it's completely understood that you are entitled to interrupts over the audio because you have no other way of making your comment or question heard. And for the rest of the items on this slide, this is pretty much what we covered earlier. Again, if some participants join late or if there's something that's still unclear, please don't hesitate to ask me. And with that, I'll hand it back over to Heather and Mary. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you very much, Natalie. We're at the top of the hour, I notice, and with what remains, I suppose, Mary, maybe you and I simply field questions. What you see here is a diagram showing the GNSO structure, and this represents the two houses. We've had some questions in the chat about houses. Mary, is there anything specifically that you think we ought to mention beyond that about structure?
No, I think the diagram pretty much shows it, and it's one of those things where it's probably easier to understand once you are an active participant. I think one thing I did want to note was what Amma said in the chat earlier, that while these groups are the structures by which, you know, you feed back information to the council and so forth, in terms of participating in a working group, you don't have to be a member of one of the constituencies or stakeholder groups or houses to participate. You can, but you don't have to.
Well, that's a good point, Mary. Thank you very much. Let's see. Maybe we look at those questions very briefly. I'm just conscious of time and not running over too far. How can I get an observer status or represent the company I work for within the working groups? I think that, Natalie, you very helpfully described, let's say, how observer status comes about, that that's an option that you have when joining. And I've given some information about how to join, let's say, and responding to a call for volunteers and what you would then need to do. If you have further questions about that, what I would recommend is Mary and Natalie are both experts on the how, and I would encourage you to reach out to them. What is my ICANN affiliation? I wonder if that question goes to houses and members of stakeholder groups and constituencies, and Mary's just picked up on that point. And suggestions on working groups for newer members to get involved in. That's a brilliant question, and I wonder, Amr, Mary, I don't know that there's any particular group. There's no group that's easier than another, perhaps.
Heather, this is Mary. I'm not sure that there is one answer for everybody. What I'm going to do is I'm putting a page in the chat that has all the active working groups within the GNSO right now. You can click on each one of them to see which stage they are, and this goes back to the snake diagram again. And so, as we said earlier, you can join a working group at any time. Of course, it gets a little harder if the group is already advanced in its work, but harder only in the sense that you've got more to catch up on. So our suggestion would be to look at that page, and as Heather says, contact any of us on the staff or her or Amma or anyone else who is always very open to questions, and just find one topic that you think is interesting to you or a group that you may represent. And if you're going to join, just let us know, and we will walk you through it.
Well, I think that's a helpful point. And in terms of joining a working group, to the extent that there's a topic that you have an interest in or have a baseline of knowledge in, or perhaps your organization is involved in or has an interest in, then that might be an easier way, a softer landing, I suppose, into joining. And Mary's email there with the list of working groups, I think, is a very helpful one. And bear in mind, again, as Natalie said, it's possible to join a group initially as an observer, and that might give you an opportunity just to see how the process works and get your head around things. And Tracy asked a question about secretariat. Can secretariat join a working group? And I haven't any idea what the answer to that question is. Mary, Natalie, can you bail me out?
I don't know, Tracy, if you're asking about, you know, secretariat staff from another organization, for example. In terms of the internal ICANN secretariat, we're considered, or they're considered, support staff. And so to the extent that you are, you know, working with an ICANN group, whether that's the GNSO or some other group, then you would probably be support staff as well. And in that capacity, it would be slightly different from a working group participant who may be representing what I can call an external interest, if that helps.
Marvelous. Thank you very, very much for that answer. And I think we've reached the end of our slides. I would say, given the time, if you have further questions, I'm very happy to do my best to answer them. Again, I rely very heavily on Mary and Natalie and Glenn and Lars. I think they're absolutely amazing staff, and they haven't paid me to say this. It's midnight my time, so I can assure you I wouldn't do this if I didn't have the utmost respect and admiration for what staff do. So with that in mind, I will close us off. I'll turn to Mary and Natalie for any last-minute housekeeping, and that would be the end for me.
Well, I don't think there's anything from me except to echo Heather's thanks, except now I'd like to thank her and thank you guys and gals for joining us. As always, please feel free to reach out to us. You see here an email for the secretariat. We very much look forward to welcoming all of you to the GNSO, whether that be on one of our working groups, as an observer, or as a participant, or as an attendee at an ICANN meeting. Remember that you don't have to be at an ICANN meeting to participate in the GNSO. So on that note, unless anyone has any last-minute questions, Wisdom, we noticed your question, and this is something that our secretariat will try and take up on the calendar. But on that note, thank you all again. Thank you, Heather. Thank you, Amma, for helping us out. And we will talk to you all very soon, we hope. Thank you.
Marvelous. Take care. Bye now.
Thank you very much, all. You may now stop the recording. Bye-bye.